Now, had you met Musica Electronica Viva at this point?
No, that was later when I returned to Rome. That was in 68. First, after Buenos Aires, Irene and I went back to went to New York and lived in New York for a year. And the scene was worse than ever. It was really hard. Irene was babysitting, and I was working days. And I think I had one or two gigs the whole year. And but we had a group, and the group was with Enrico Rava and Carl Berger on vibes, Paul Motian on drums, and I think Kent Carter on bass. And I was writing. I was starting to write then. I started to write in 67. In 67, the year in New York. After the experience, the completely free experience, we went into what I call the post-free, where because playing completely free, it was fantastic. It lasted for a while, but after about a year of playing like that, it started to sound the same, and it was no longer free.
You were chained down to the free.
It sounded the same every night because, and that's what we didn't want. So we had to go into the post-free, and we had to like put limits on it and stop here, go loud here. We went into like a graphic period where we made little instructions. So and so play up to here. You start here. I begin. There were no notes, but there were limits. There were guideposts. And I remember that began because I had a film to score. Somebody asked me to score a film, and I had this little free group. But there were very precise scenes to do, so we started to write down little instructions. And that's how the post-free period began. And then I started trying to really write lines and things. And Irene was a wonderful singer, and I always loved a song. And so I started to try and set some things for her to sing. And that's when I wrote my very first pieces. The very first one was The Way.
Where does the Roba album fit into this?
Roba, that was a little bit later when we went back to Rome in 68. See, we took this quintet to Europe. We had a couple of gigs in 68. And then the work ran out. We couldn't get any more work. So some people went back to New York, and Irene and I decided to go back to Rome, where it was cheap to live and where we could maybe, hang out for a while and try and survive and get something going, maybe form another group and get some work. So we went back to Rome, and that's when I met Musica Electronica Viva, although we already knew Teitelbaum, Richard Teitelbaum, and we had done some things in New York in 67 with him in protest against the Vietnamese War. We were doing these polemic things from the Lao Tzu, and Irene was shouting, and Richard was on the synthesizer, and I was on the saxophone. So that when we got to Rome, Teitelbaum brought us into that group, and I started working with that group, really, Musica Electronica Viva. And I also, we were playing with amateurs. Roba was a work of amateurs, but it came out of the movement called Arte Povera, poor art. We were involved in art galleries and with playing in shows. There was this stuff is vast, but there was a movement called Fluxus, And we were involved with some of those people, Giuseppe Chiari and Mario Merz with Art. And we were playing, we were also doing a lot of experimental things with sound. We were playing objects. We were playing cars. We were playing traffic sounds. We were playing banging on the walls. I mean, it was a period where it was really a radical experimentation going on.
A lot of which, I think, came from John Cage's influence.
He was a big part of that. He was involved, yes. He was certainly a figure. I met him at that time also.
Late 60s?
In 68 in Rome, 69. Mm-hmm. We heard a few things, and I was knocked out by it, yeah. We were all very, very struck by Cage. Cage was very important. Also, Morton Feldman.
Mm-hmm. So the next move was to Paris.
Yeah, well, we were doing these things in Rome, but we weren't surviving. It was impossible to get enough work to live on in Rome. Also, I was writing, and we were playing with amateurs, and they couldn't even read my writing. And we didn't have a good rhythm section. We had an amateur drummer, and Paris beckoned because there were good musicians there. I played a festival outside of Paris, and I heard all the musicians who were at that time living in Paris, and there was Anthony Braxton, Leo Smith, and Jarman, and all these people, and Bobby Few, and Frank Wright, and they were all living in Paris. I said, well, let's go to Paris, you know, there's more happening there, good musicians there, we can find what we... So in 1970, Irene and I moved to Paris from Rome, and we began all over again, and that's where we found all the people that we worked with for a long time afterward, and we're still in Paris.
Right. And that's where the album, the recent reissue, Scratching the 70s, covers
Scratching
that.
Scratching the 70s, is the five records that we made for Sarava in the 70s, including Roba, which was actually made in Rome. But that was the first record. I sold them that tape, and that was our first Sarava record.
So the structure that you were talking about in the first piece you wrote, called The Way.
The Way, yeah.
After your year of free improvisation,
mm-hmm.
the 4/4 time, the melodic contours, the harmonic implications started to come back, or actually started to emerge,
mm-hmm.
From that period.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like you had all of this schooling from 1950 onwards, listening to all of this music, mm-hmm. and studying Bach, mm-hmm. and studying Ellington and studying Monk.
That's right, yeah.
And then you threw it all away for, mm-hmm. about a year and played completely free.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of like you had to clean the slate,
yeah.
before you could start your own.
We had to make another revolution. We made one revolution, and then in order to maintain that revolution, we had to make a second one on top of it. It's always like that. It's about freedom. It's about liberty. And in order to maintain that, you have to continually make another revolution, really.
And this time with structure.
This time, we have to start to structure this stuff that we had discovered. And that was what we call the post-free. And then later, when harmony and chords and everything started to come back, we call that poly-free. Because there was a position where certain things were free and other things were not. And we were free not to be free. And that's when the polyfree came in. And there was really a mixture where C major came back. But C major was no longer like it was. C major was wide open. It was wide open. Nothing was the same anymore because it had been through the cleaners. So that was fascinating, really.
And Steve Potts' introduction to your band must have had a big impact in terms of your melodic harmonization.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, we found the people that we wanted to play with in Paris. We formed a group, and it went through various metamorphoses. Potts joined the band in 72 or 73.
It must have been 72 because that's when I was there.
72.
Yeah, right.
And that was the beginning of the front line. But there we had the front line with Irene and Potts and myself. That was the front line. And the back and the rhythm section went through various things. Sometimes it was a quintet, sometimes a sextet. But the group lasted over 20 years, really. And we kept that going through thick and thin, really, for a long time, really, until 95, I think.
And what kind of harmonizations did you apply when Steve Potts joined the band? Were you hearing all of that, the intervallic structures, or were you...
Well, in the 70s, there was I was inventing the stuff myself, really. I wasn't going by any models and all that. We were trying to find our own thing, really. And I was into seconds, minor and major seconds. For me, that was the whole world. Everything could be either unison or minor second or major seconds. That's all I was doing for years, really. I was really into that. It was a kind of what I called Rayonism. You know, there was a movement in painting, like Rayonist, where they had like ribbons of color that were like rays.
Morris Lewis?
No, this is a long time before that. This is in the 19-teens.
Oh.
These are some Russian painters, Larionov and a few others, and also from some of the futurist painters from Italy. But there, it was a kind of like a thickening of a line. If you have like one line and you add and you put seconds to it, it makes it thicker. And what we were into was a mixture of minor and major seconds. And so Potts and I were playing in seconds mostly, in minor and major seconds, sometimes in unison and mixtures of those things. And then the harmony was in blocks underneath that. And it was very complex, very complex. But we went through this really complex period like that in the 70s, also because I didn't really know what I was doing. It took me a long time to find out what I was doing.
I find that hard to believe that you didn't know what you were doing.
No. It's very important to do what you don't know what you're doing. In other words, to be lost, to be groping, to be a research, and you don't exactly know. It comes clear after a while, but it's not clear. When I was 38 years old, I sort of realized, that's what I'm doing. I began to see what I was doing when I was 38. And in fact, I wrote a piece called 38 at that time. And it began to come clear to me there. But it wasn't until the late 70s and the 80s that the music started to get more clear and simplified, and that we got away from the seconds, and we got into triadic harmony. But it was new, it was brand new, and I rewrote a lot of my music, and in the 80s, I rewrote a lot of the stuff from the 70s in a much more simplified way. And in fact, the piece called The Way was rewritten innumerable times. Not the melody. The melody was never changed, but the rhythm was changed and the harmony was changed. And it took me years and years before I could even get it finally where I didn't have to rewrite it anymore.
So you were finally pleased with it?
Yeah, and in fact, it's never been recorded that way.
Interesting.
The way it's finally, it's written, it's all prepared, but we got away from that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't play that anymore.
When you're traveling now with your trio,
yeah.
Do you miss having that second horn up there for those harmonizations?
Well, we got Roswell Rudd coming up. We're starting to play with Roswell. Roswell is going to join us for, I think, 5 gigs on this tour. And he's also coming to Paris, and we have a week at a club there, and we have about, a dozen gigs coming up with Roswell, plus the trio. Now, this is the new beginning.
So it'll be a new period.
Yeah.
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 And the last time you were in town, you mentioned to me that your whole life is a world tour now. Things have changed a great deal since the Scratching the 70s period, when the gigs were not forthcoming as they are now.
And no, actually, there were, you know, in Paris in the 70s, we were working much more than I work now in Paris. I hardly do anything in Paris now. But in the 70s, we were only in Paris. We weren't going anywhere else. And we were playing, again, off the door and for peanuts. But we could live off it after a while. But we were really scuffling for a while in Paris. We came to Paris and we had a really... But we weren't alone. That was what was important. There were other musicians there also. And we were... There was a hotbed scene going on in Paris in the 70s. It was really a wonderful period. But it was very hard financially, but there was a lot going on musically.
And then in the 80s, it started opening up.
Yeah, we started getting successful in the 80s, yeah. We were working with dancers a lot. I mean, that's something I do a lot. And we were working with various dance groups and individual dancers, and we started putting on our own shows in the 80s, dance theater shows and... I was writing a lot of songs for Irene, and the music was really opening up in the 80s. It really got very clear. And we were doing all kinds of things. And in the 90s, it sort of dried up. Paris really got... and right now, it's not very good there.
But for you, in the 90s, it was 1992 when you got your MacArthur Fellowship?
Yeah.
So your career... really seems to have exploded since that time.
Yeah. Well, it's hard for me to... I can't analyze all that, really. We just go through it day by day and do what we can, really. And there's a lot of realized things and there's a lot of unrealized things. I mean, I have drawers full of stuff that we've never even done. And I have other things that are sort of half done. And there's other things that we've done. So there's a vast amount of material, really... But we have a saying, where's the gig? And that's always been the problem, and it's still the problem. Because if I could do what I really wanted to do, then we could realize the things that are unrealized. But I can't. I can only do what the gig allows me to do. So a sextet was extremely difficult to maintain. Six people, six... airplane tickets, six hotel rooms, and I mean, you know, we were really, it was no joke, and also we didn't get very much help in maintaining that sextet, really. I mean, I think we had one of the best groups in the world at that point, but we didn't get really recognition for that, really, and we were fighting with record companies and all that, and it's been a struggle. So finally... that group broke up, and it stripped down to the trio now. And also I work with Irene as a duo quite a lot. And in another trio with a harpsichord player we work with. And various combinations, and also solo concerts and duos and the work I do with Mal Waldron. It's a variety of things I do. And working with dancers, too, has been extremely important in what we do both ballet and modern. And in Paris is like a capital of dance, really, and we were able to work with wonderful dancers there. And that was going on in the 70s and the 80s and still. So it's about song and dance.
You're a song and dance man.
That's it, man. Those are the two poles of music, and if there isn't a song and there isn't a dance, it's just not for me.
You have a new opera out called The Cry.
It's not so new. It's from 96. 96, we were invited to Berlin for 1 year under the grant, the DAAD grant. Irene and I went to Berlin, and there we met Taslima Nasrin, the Bangladesh writer, and she was under the same program. In fact, she was living in the same building as we were in Berlin. And I had already set one of her poems to music, and Irene was, we were performing it, and it was called The Cry. And when we met Taslima, we got more interested in her other material, and we decided, actually it was Irene's idea, let's make an opera. And so during that whole year of 96, we worked on that. I wrote all this material, and we rehearsed and rehearsed. And finally, in the beginning of 97, we started performing this, The Cry, with an ensemble, actually a new sextet. The only one from the old sextet was Jean-Jacques on bass, Jean-Jacques Avenel, and Irene and myself. But the other people were Petja Kaufman on harpsichord, and Catherine Pfeiffer on accordion, and Topo on percussion. And these are not jazz musicians. And it's been very important for me, to work with non-jazz musicians. It's like the mixture. I find it very fruitful to collaborate with people in other disciplines. People like Musica Electronica Viva, those were not jazz musicians at all. They came out of the conservatories. But they were interested in improvisation. And there was a common ground for us. And the people in The Cry also are not jazz musicians. There's only Jean-Jacques and myself are the only jazz musicians in there. The other people come out of conservatories or world music or different disciplines. And we built that up, and then we started performing it, and we played it about 16 times by now in the last 2 years. And the record is just coming out now. And I'm very curious to see how the reaction will be. But it's been very controversial. Some of the critics hated it. We had, hostile reactions from critics in Berlin, in Switzerland. And we had a lot of obstacles. You know, there's a resistance. There's a built-in resistance to anything original. There's going to be resistance at first. And the more original it is, the more resistance. I found that out when I was working with Cecil. Because the 6 years I was with him, it was like resistance, obstacles. And it took him, as I say, before 20 years, before the people who said no, they started saying, well, maybe. And then finally they said, oh, yes. And that's a process that goes on in all kinds of culture, really, art. And any kind of originality is going to meet with resistance.
It seems, though, that that given that you're on a tour right now that's one-nighters up till pretty close to the end of April, that on the one hand, you're being said yes to in jazz clubs working with your trio.
Oh, the trio works like a charm, man. The trio, we have a good time, and we've been playing together so long. I mean, I've been playing with John Betch for 10 years now and with Jean-Jacques for 25 years. And so we know each other very like a football team. You know, we could take a lot of risks, a lot of liberties. We have a lot of fun. And that communicates. People can dig it, you know.
And last night was the first date on this
tour.
That
was the beginning, yeah.
Have you rehearsed before this? I mean, or did you, before you left for the tour?
Sometimes we have rehearsals when we have new material to add.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't need to rehearse. We have so much old stuff that we know that we can perform. But we do. I do like to renew the book and add some new material always, a couple of new things. And so we're going to rehearse this afternoon as a couple of recent pieces that we're not really secure with yet. So that's the only time we rehearse is when we add new material.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, it seems like you're being said no to in terms of at least some of the critical reaction to The Cry. I mean, that side of your music.
You know, more original than me, in a way, is Irene. Irene to me is unique. There, I don't know anybody. I've been trying to think of anybody in the whole world who can deal with the material that she deals with. She only sings what I wrote for her. And what I wrote for her was extremely difficult stuff. And the texts it's highfalutin stuff that we use. It's literature. We deal in literature. And I don't know any singer in the world who sings Samuel Beckett and Taslima Nasrin and Brian Geisen and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and all these you know, there's nobody that deals with that even, that would dare to do that. And she doesn't scat, and she doesn't sing Body and Soul or Breen Dolphin Street or anything like that. She does what she does, and she's got a European accent. She sings in four languages. She's Swiss, so we have material in Italian, German, English, and French. And she has realized we made hundreds of pieces, and she sang Buckminster Fuller. That was one of the first pieces I wrote for her, was the Buckminster Fuller piece in 68. And, you know, can you think of any other singer in the world that does that? I can't.
No.
And she has taken so much flack from critics and fundamentalists.
Well, they're expecting Billie Holiday, right?
Yeah, but she's not Sarah or Billie or any of those, or Abby or any of those things. She does what she does, and nobody else can do it. But that sound and that, it's just a resistance. And then the critics, after a while, they say, well, it's a matter of getting used to. And they start to get used to it, and some of them start to like it now. So there again, it takes quite a while before people get habituated and they catch up. Monk told me the same thing. He said, you do what you do, and people catch up with you after a while.
Thank you, Steve, very much for this interview. It's been great.
All right.
It's been great.
Thank you. That's one of the first pieces I wrote a long time ago called The Crust. And it's a portrait of Rex Stewart, who was a godfather to me, who gave me my name, actually. When I worked with Rex Stewart, he said, how do you spell your name? I said, L-A-C-K-R-I-T-Z. He said, I can't spell that. I'll call you Lacey.